Blog Talk Radio.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The room was completely black. I hugged her and she hugged back. Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just a beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. I've sunshine enough to spread. It's just like the fella said. Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head? Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. She's telling me we'll be wed. She's picked out a king-size bed. I couldn't feel any better, or I'd be sick. Tell me quick, boy, ain't love a kick. Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head.
James Bostic, a conservative's perspective here on Patriot Nation Radio. We do it live twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have a recorded version of the program as well that goes out on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, well, you should be, because it is the best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. Mojo50.com. Just like the outstanding programming you're going to catch here on Patriot Nation Radio. And one of the things that we are really, really tanked up about this coming Monday, July 26th, 7 p.m. on United Patriots Uprising with our host and good friend Gary Benford. Exclusive interview, Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn. Yes, that Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn. Our man Gary's got it. You're not going to want to miss a second of that. July 26th, 7 p.m., United Patriots Uprising. This coming Monday, less than a week away. That's huge, man. I've been thinking about that for a while, and it was just, you know, just serendipitous, I guess, that he just scored this interview. And Gary's got that gift. He has a uniqueness about him that if I had known this first, that night at Rock the Red, I would have looked at him and said, you know, you need to be booking guests for my program instead of you need a program of your own. Oh man, what a stooge move was that. Holy, but this July 26th, General Michael T. Flynn. And this is a huge thing for Patriots. It's a great thing and a huge thing for Gary Benford, the man, the talk show host, and for United Patriots Uprising, and all the way, you know, down to us here at Patriot Nation Radio. And we're really proud to be a part of this. There's some good things happening here at Patriot Nation. If you haven't heard, we've added a couple programs to the lineup. We have Kevin White, author Kevin White, Brownie Fox Publications, has a show on Wednesday nights, tomorrow night, concerning the Constitution. You're going to check that out. And, of course, Ron Edwards, host of the Ron Edwards American Experience, a terrestrial syndicated talk show, is in a collaborative effort with us. And what we do is we do a live simulcast of Ron Edwards' program on Sundays, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's some good stuff, too. And as a matter of fact, the last half hour of the program tonight will be Ron Edwards joining us. So, as the teaser said, can things get any worse? Oh. Oh, hell yes. Hell yes, they can. And most likely will. There, once again, I call this kind of the silly season. And I'm not trying to, because there's a lot of serious things that are going on, but there's serious things that have been ongoing. You know, our border's been, the southern border's been leaking like a sieve since Biden took his hand off the Bible, fundamentally. And I think it probably singed a little bit because, you know, he kind of popped up off of that. Anyway, so that's been going on. We've got, as we heard from the Jexit girls a couple of weeks back, a rising wave of anti-Semitism here on the, and it's represented fully by the Marxist and progressive left. Critical race theory is a poison within our military system. We're going to get into that here in just a little bit, too. But these things have been going on for a while now. I mean, it's not exactly news. I guess the news is that it's still happening, and it's doing this, nigh on irreparable damage. And to give you a good example of what I'm talking about, Mark Milley is a name you may not be familiar with, but you should be because he's he's chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he's in a unique position within the authority hierarchy of the United States military. And he's been a strong proponent of advancing critical race theory throughout the military and throughout the military's institutions. And by that, I mean Annapolis, West Point, and the Air Force Academy. Tucker Carlson had, I don't even know when this was. I guess it was last night. This stuff is so fresh. As usual, Tuck runs a little bit long, but there's a reason for that. He's got a lot of points to make, and he does a fairly good job of it. And I would rather you hear him once again than me half-ass paraphrasing it. So I'm just going to scroll down here. I've got to clean this out. We have a clip bank, and we've been talking like for 2 years how it how it needs to be cleared out. What the hell is that? Okay, Tucker, Mark Milley. All right. Okay, here we go. This was, and this critical race thing, we've talked about it a lot. As a matter of fact, as the headlining topic of one of Gary Binford's programs, just as we were getting into the full swing of that discussion, we were mysteriously cut off by Blog Talk, technical difficulties, I'm sure, but as you can remember, a couple of weeks back when that happened. But here's Tucker Carlson and what he has to say about what's going on with this guy. And this dude is really dangerous.
Yeah, welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Here's a story we'd completely forgotten about because there are so many. Just before last November's presidential election, two former Army officers wrote an open letter to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a man called Mark Milley, who still has the job. The letter became public. It was published on a left-wing blog called Defense One, and within minutes was all over the internet. The authors of the letter had a direct order for Mark Milley, who, strictly speaking, did not report to them. Quote, "If Donald Trump refuses to leave office," the letter began, "the United States military must remove him by force, and you must give that order. You must remove the president by force." That was a little shocking. What country is this? Even the usual power-mad partisans in the news media began to wonder if that was really a good idea. Slate.com, of all places, reminded its readers that no matter how orange Donald Trump might be, military coups generally turn out to be unwise. The Pentagon had to go on the record as opposing it, too. The rest of us could keep civilian control of our government, and what a relief that was. Within days, the story just kind of receded, another weird footnote to a weird 4 years. But if you paused and thought about it for a second, you had to wonder, where did that idea even come from? Did two former U.S. military officers really just suggest removing the President of the United States by force of arms? Since when do American military officers talk like that or think like that? And do a lot of them have views like that? We pushed that consideration from our minds, but we shouldn't have. Now we know that Mark Milley himself is the sort of person who considers military coups entirely within the realm of possibility. A new book written by reporters at the Washington Post who cover Mark Milley reveals that the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is a legitimate extremist. He's the last person you would give power to if you could possibly help it. In the book, Milley describes Donald Trump and the millions of people who supported him as the moral equivalent of Adolf Hitler. As thousands of Trump supporters peacefully gathered in Washington for what they assumed was a constitutionally protected political rally, the kind we've had for hundreds of years shortly after the election, Milley likened them to brown shirts, that is the paramilitary wing of the Nazi Party. Trump's complaints about voter fraud, Milley explained to his advisors out loud, were actually calls for genocide. This is a Reichstag moment, Milley said, the gospel of the Führer. Those are quotes. Think about that. So your grandfather joined the U.S. military to go overseas to risk his life to fight the Nazis. Now the head of the U.S. military calls you a Nazi for having your grandfather's political views. What do you think of that? Keep in mind that Mark Milley is a man the media tells us is a deep intellectual, someone who reads books and stuff, not just Wikipedia. And yet this well-read man of history is comparing nearly half of our country to Adolf Hitler. And that would include, by the way, the many Hispanics in the Rio Grande Valley who voted for Trump because they agreed with him on immigration. Mark Milley isn't just your average guy with crackpot views. Mark Milley has control of nuclear weapons. Are we okay with this? The people on TV are okay with it.
You read what Milley was doing, and which, you know, is obeying the Constitution. It's standing up to the oath that he and serving members have taken. I mean, that's what a patriot does.
General Milley and his team in the military with the courage to stand up, to realize that something was going horribly off the rails with the President of the United States.
Thank goodness. General Milley was there, and other generals, I think, all saw this guy's flaws.
It is jaw-dropping. There's no other way around it. They may be the guys with the guns, but Milley was going to make darn sure that those guns were not used.
You think of General Milley, and you think of someone who chooses every word with intention and is a student of history. And to use the words he used, like Nazi and Reichstag, says a lot.
He's a student of history. They're easy to impress over on CNN. Make a reference to the Nazis and the Reichstag fire, and you must be a highbrow grad school guy. You hear someone compare his enemies to Nazis, you know he went to Princeton. Pretty funny. So we've established that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is on the same intellectual plane as the midday newsreaders on CNN. The problem is, he's a lot more powerful than they are. According to the Washington Post's account, Mark Milley is the reason that thousands of American soldiers occupied our Capitol this year ahead of Joe Biden's inauguration. Quote, "We're going to put a ring of steel around this city, and the Nazis aren't getting in," Milley said, referring to American citizens. A ring of steel to repel the QAnon shaman and several hundred senior citizens from Orlando with signs. This is a guy, by the way, who's paid to assess threats realistically. What countries pose a threat to the United States? Put them in order. If you think the QAnon shaman is the same as the SS, maybe you're not so good at that. Then Milley gave a speech straight out of a 1990s Bruce Willis flick, quote, "Everything is going to be okay. We're going to have a peaceful transfer of power. We're going to land this plane safely. This is America. It's strong. The institutions are bending, but it won't break." In the end, no Nazi attack ever came, much to Mark Milley's apparent disappointment. It wasn't Dunkirk. Now, you'd think that would be an embarrassment to Mark Milley. You give a speech like that and nothing happens. Some guy dressed like Chewbacca shows up. But no. He was not embarrassed. In fact, later he gave a speech, testimony to Congress, and said, apparently not referring to himself, that he understands white rage better than anyone.
I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university, and it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white, and I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that? I want to find that out. I want to maintain an open mind here, and I do want to analyze it. It's important that we understand that because our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians, they come from the American people. So it is important that the leaders, now and in the future, do understand it.
White rage, just a casual racial slur. These people have no self-awareness. But he tells us he spent many hours reading Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi, learning about white rage, but that white rage never came. Mark Milley was not deterred by that. Instead, soon after the election, the Post reports, quote, Milley began informally planning with other military leaders, strategizing how they would block Trump's order to use the military in a way they deemed dangerous or illegal, end quote. Now, wait a second, just pause here for a moment. Is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff the guy who's empowered by our Constitution, our democracy, to make those decisions? No, he's not. We have civilian leadership. He can't make them independently. If he disagrees, he can resign. But he can't make them independently because that would be a junta. But he kept going. In early January, Nancy Pelosi pressed for specifics to Mark Milley. She wanted to know what the generals had done to help her. She wanted to know that they were doing things that were illegal, taking control of the military from civilian elected leaders. And Mark Milley didn't blush. He confirmed they had done just that. Quote, ma'am, Milley told Nancy Pelosi, I guarantee you that we have checks and balances in the system. End quote. Yeah, Jackson. Yeah, they're written into the Constitution, Mr. Milley. Maybe that's not on Wikipedia. According to the Post, some of those checks and balances he referred to involved undermining the elected president's authority to choose the director of the CIA. It's interesting, by the way. A lot of focus on the CIA tells you what kind of power they have. So when the president reportedly considered firing Gina Haspel, who runs the CIA, and replacing her with a man called Kash Patel in the closing days of his administration, we now know that Milley pressured the president's chief of staff not to do that, to keep Haspel. What the hell is going on here, Milley asked Trump's chief of staff. What are you guys doing? This is lunacy. It's not how the government's supposed to work. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs should not be having that conversation, expressing those views. He should leave if he can't keep them to himself. That quote right there is alone grounds for Mark Milley's immediate firing from his job. No chairman of the Joint Chiefs has say over CIA appointees. No one in the military does. They can't. Talk about a threat to our system. And yet the Washington Post thinks this is fine because the president at the time was talking about election fraud, and that was inciting an insurrection. Scary. We already know that Milley had subverted civilian control of the military long before the election even took place. On February 29th of last year, the Trump administration reached a deal with the Taliban to end U.S. military involvement in that country after only 20 years. Immediately, the Pentagon, led by Mark Milley, conspired to kill the deal, which they are not allowed to do under our Constitution, but they did it anyway. According to reporting by the Gray Zone, quote, with startling swiftness and determination, Pentagon officials and military leadership exploited the open-ended terms of the ceasefire to derail the implementation of the agreement, end quote. No informed person denies that happened. It did. The head of U.S. Central Command, Kenneth McKenzie, testified before Congress the deal would be determined by, quote, conditions on the ground, meaning the decision would be made not by civilian leaders, but by the Pentagon. Again, threat to democracy, anyone? There it is. Acting unilaterally, the Pentagon launched more than 30 drone attacks and 8 night raids led by special operators against the Taliban. And within weeks, the peace deal was dead. They killed it. Voters had no say in this. They operated completely independently like they run the country. A little scarier than the QAnon shaman. Ironically, preserving a peace deal with the Taliban was the same justification that Mark Milley used later, in late 2020, to overrule Donald Trump's order to pull out of Afghanistan. Milley told the president it was only possible to remove half American forces there, not all. Now, no one in the media seems concerned by any of this. In fact, the Washington Post, which supports authoritarianism, is already publishing follow-up op-eds explaining that Mark Milley's a hero. There are Nazis among us, you! And therefore, we need to get rid of the filibuster. Try to follow that logic. They're also noting with approval that Mark Milley smiled at Michelle Obama when Joe Biden was inaugurated. So the question is, why is Mark Milley still in command of the U.S. military? This is not a small question. If what the Washington Post reporters are reporting, it's a question we need to deal with right now.
And I'm inclined to agree. Having said that, what do you think is going to happen? Yeah, that, absolutely. I mean, it's shocking news. It's alarming news. But fundamentally, okay, now we know. All right, we just have Tucker Carlson has done the great example of how things can get worse. You remember when things getting worse? Oh hell yeah, they came right here. This is a great example of it. This has been going on for months now. This guy's been doing this. It is a cancer in our military. It destroys their readiness capabilities. It devastates our abilities to win wars, which is kind of important if we want to survive as a nation. And here's the thing that gets me. All these guys on the left, these wing nuts like this guy right here, like Milley, Nazis. Nazis. Holy cow. And Nazism has been dead for almost 80 years. Vestiges of it here and there, yes, as there are vestiges of racism and evil all over the world. Did it ever come close, anywhere near, to posing the threat that it posed in 1939, 1940? As a matter of fact, this would have been the week in 1940 that the Battle of Britain would have begun. My God, I'm going to watch that tonight. But it's always Nazis. When look at what the Chinese communists are doing, and we're going to talk about that here in a little bit too. Not dead air. Getting a drink of some first-rate homemade lemonade. Compliments my good friend Heather Brown. Thanks, Brian. Mixed up with ginger ale. Canada Dry ginger ale, the best ginger ale in a half-and-half spritzer. That is delicious. So where were we? Oh, communism is the threat. Communism is the existential threat that faces the United States today. But the chairman of the Joint Damn Chief of Staff says what? Nazis. Reichstag, Hitler. What in the hell, dude? And there's a reason for this. And that begs the question, why isn't communism reviled the way that Nazism is reviled? Again, Nazism's been dead for close to 80 or 76 years. It was the last time that Nazism posed an existential threat to the world. 76 years. Nobody says you dirty, rotten commie, you filthy, stinking commie, you red bastard. I mean, nobody says that. No, it's you dirty, filthy Nazi, you rotten, stinking Nazi, you Nazi bastard. And I don't get it. It should be the commie bastards, not Nazis. There's no Nazi bastards anymore. God, they're like, it's 76 years ago. Commie bastards everywhere you want to look. But we're not going to talk about that. Well, yeah, we will talk about it. I pulled up a pretty cool clip, and we're going to run that here in a minute. But the point is, you know, this guy is a career military officer, all right? That means he's been in, looking at him, a minimum of 40 years. And there were guys like him. They're not in the, you know, they may not be on the Joint Chiefs, but they're in positions of importance throughout all branches of the military. There are generals and admirals in positions within the military that pose just as dangerous a threat as this General Milley. It's just that we don't know about him. We know about General Milley because he's chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And so there we are. But these other guys, we don't know who they are. We don't know where they are. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know what they are capable of doing or what they would be willing to do to further advance their ideology. And those are frightening thoughts. Those are very frightening thoughts indeed. Man, that is good lemonade. So, in answer, yeah, that's our first point. Can things get any worse? Absolutely, they can. Absolutely, they can. On a good note, though, I think the motivation, and I'm sure it doesn't surprise anybody by now, you know, all the talk about the Delta variant, whatever the hell that is, that, you know, that we've got to be peeing in our pants over that now. And everything that we find out, it's a waiting game, I guess. You know, the arithmetic is not matching. Their arithmetic and the arithmetic of the truth don't add up. And every day we get a little bit more out of what's going on. But again, all it does is, like Claire Lopez told us, you know, we've talked about it. We've talked about this for a year and a half. We know where the virus came from. We know how it was manufactured. We know it got away. And rather than work on an effective policy of containment, the communist Chinese decided to direct it as best they could in a weaponized fashion against the West. Now that is in and of itself shocking. But when we couple this with the fact that American tax dollars probably helped pay, well, did help pay, we know it. The American tax dollars helped pay for this gain of function research, which is fundamentally weaponizing existing viruses into something really nasty that's tough to shake off and maybe kill, I don't know, say 4-5 million people, you know. Well, today, once again, Dr. Fauci is testifying, and it's getting worse and worse for this guy. He's not backing down off of anything. I look at him in these videos, and his eyes, something about the eye. You guys got to check out his pictures. You know, it's something recent with over the last month or two when he's like really been in the hot seat over this stuff. And you know, the only place he goes these days, I think, is CNN. They're the only guys that still buy into this. He won't go anywhere else. Somebody else will talk to him. But Rand Paul today went after him, and he went after him in high style. And I'm going to have to pull that up, which I should have had ready. But, you know, Rand Paul. I got a Rand Paul clip. I'm not really such a Rand Paul fan. But he does a great job in these. Here we are. Fauci lies to Congress. Only about 4 minutes. Here we go. This is awesome stuff. And listen to how Fauci's on the run, man. Listen.
Dr. Fauci, as you are aware, it is a crime to lie to Congress. Section 1001 of the U.S. Criminal Code creates a felony and a 5-year penalty for lying to Congress. On your last trip to our committee on May 11th, you stated that the NIH has not ever and does not now fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And yet, gain-of-function research was done entirely in the Wuhan Institute by Dr. Xi and was funded by the NIH. I'd like to ask unanimous consent to insert into the record the Wuhan virology paper entitled Discovery of a Rich Gene Pool of Bat SARS-Related Coronaviruses. Please deliver a copy of the journal article to Dr. Fauci. In this paper, Dr. Xi credits the NIH and lists the actual number of the grant that she was given by the NIH. In this paper, she took two bat coronavirus genes, spike genes, and combined them with a SARS-related backbone to create new viruses that are not found in nature. These lab-created viruses were then shown to replicate in humans. These experiments combined genetic information from different coronaviruses that infect animals but not humans to create novel artificial viruses able to infect human cells. Viruses that in nature only infect animals were manipulated in the Wuhan lab to gain the function of infecting humans. This research fits the definition of the research that the NIH said was subject to the pause in 2014 to 2017, a pause in funding on gain of function. But the NIH failed to recognize this, defines it away, and it never came under any scrutiny. Dr. Richard E. Bright, a molecular biologist from Rutgers, described this research in Wuhan as, "The Wuhan lab used NIH funding to construct novel chimeric SARS-related coronaviruses able to infect human cells and laboratory animals. This is high-risk research that creates new potential pandemic pathogens that exist only in the lab, not in nature. This research matches," these are Dr. Ebright's words, "this research matches, indeed epitomizes, the definition of gain-of-function research done entirely in Wuhan, for which there was supposed to be a federal pause." Dr. Fauci, knowing that it is a crime to lie to Congress, do you wish to retract your statement of May 11th where you claimed that the NIH never funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan?
Your microphone.
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress, and I do not retract that statement. This paper that you are referring to was judged by qualified staff up and down the chain as not being gain of function.
You take an animal virus and you increase its transmissibility to humans,
right.
You're saying that's not gain of function?
Yeah, that is correct. And Senator Paul, you do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say that officially. You do not know what you are talking about.
Let's read from the NIH definition of gain of function. This is your definition that you guys wrote. It says that scientific research that increases the transmissibility among mammals is gain of function. They took animal viruses that only occur in animals, and they increased their transmissibility to humans. How you can say that is not gain of function?
It is not.
It's a dance, and you're dancing around this because you're trying to obscure responsibility for 4 million people dying around the world from a pandemic.
Ouch. Yeah, exactly.
Again, someone, anyone, tell me what is going to happen to Dr. Anthony Fauci and the other bad actors that are requisitely downstream from his source of authority, the minions, the lackeys that carry these things out, that see these agendas are pushed through. Well, let us take a look back at what's happened to anyone who has been hit in the spotlight with a cascade of overwhelming evidence of their wrongdoing, who is among the elite. What happened to Bill and Hillary Clinton? Right. What happened to Dianne Feinstein when they found out she had a Chinese intelligence operative working on her staff for 20 years? Nothing. I mean, nothing happens to anybody. What's happened to Joe and Hunter Biden and the Biden family? Nothing. And again, like I said, can it get worse? Yeah. Oh, my God, you got no idea. And it probably will. Speaking of China. I got a clip concerning the recent spate of Chinese cyber attacks against the United States. And again, this is part of a multi-point strategy that Communist China has been engaged in. And it's called unrestricted warfare. And that's exactly what it is. It's warfare from a political standpoint, from an economic standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, from a militant standpoint, military standpoint. And this is part of it. These cyber attacks are part of it. And they're testing our system. They're probing for weaknesses. They're sabotaging the systems, trying to understand how they may be able to defeat them completely. And Joe Biden was asked a couple questions about that today. And fundamentally, at issue was, why are you treating Russia and China differently when it comes to these hacking incidents? Brief clip, check it out.
Mr. President, on China and cyber hacking.
She jumps up before you do.
Effectively, your administration is naming and shaming China, but no sanctions. Why, and is that effective enough?
They're still determining exactly what happened. The investigation is not finished. Thank you all very much.
I'm trying real quick. What is your understanding of the biggest difference between what they've done versus what Russia's done in terms of cyber hacking?
That'd take a longer explanation.
We have all the time in the world. Okay.
No, we don't. I have to go see the King of Jordan. To the best of my knowledge, and I'm getting a report tomorrow morning on this, a detailed report, my understanding is that the Chinese government, not unlike the Russian government, is not doing this themselves, but are protecting those who are doing it, and maybe even accommodating them being able to do it. That may be the difference. Thank you.
Okay, let's go over that one more time. He says, look, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm getting a report tomorrow morning on this, a detailed report, which is always what he says, because his understanding is that the Chinese government, not unlike the Russian government, is not doing this themselves, but they're simply protecting the people that are doing it and maybe giving them access to the technology they need to help them to do it. That might be the difference. So you've got two answers here. One, the first one, the usual reflexive knee-jerk pablum about an ongoing investigation, we can't comment. And then the second is that the Chinese are harboring the hackers, but they're not technically state hackers. And since China's a totalitarian state with tight government oversight, the distinction basically between harboring hackers and state hacking is nebulous at best. If the hacking groups didn't serve the interests of the state of Communist China, but they undermined it, well, those guys would all be doing involuntary organ donations by this time. So the People's Republic of China sees these guys and their activities as serving the interests of Communist China. It's no different than states who harbor terrorist groups while at the same time, you know, they claim plausible deniability and say, well, we're unaware of any Islamic terrorist presence in kill a lot of Jewistan. I mean, you know, that's how it works. So beyond that, what have we got? Well, what we've got basically is they're accusing the Chinese government of doing just that. There's no distinction. He wants to say that there is a distinction. There's not. Russia or China, either one, and whether it's once removed or directly in line, they're fulfilling the wishes of the state. Chinese nationals have been indicted over a range of separate hacking intrusions that date back nearly 10 years, allegedly stealing corporate and research records from firms and universities all around the world. Three of them were described as MSS officers, MSS, Ministry of State Security, China's intelligence service. So maybe Joe gets that detailed report tomorrow. He can have somebody explain it to him in a few short words. But more aptly, it comes down to this. Biden doesn't have any appetite for confrontation with China, who not only owns his son, but much of his donor base. And despite appearances, he has the appetite for confrontation with Russia. The only political appetite he seems to have is one for a domestic crackdown on his opponents, which leaves him with a lot in common with China and Russia. Not dead air. Tell you what, we're going to go ahead and take a little break. We will be back. I'm going to move the microphone out of the way because what the hell I'm doing. We will be back with more of a conservative perspective just as soon as I find something to listen to. And I don't know what that's... It's all good. It's totally good. We'll be back with more of a conservative perspective right after this.
Someday I'll have me a chauffeur and a block-long limousine, EO11. EO11. Someday I'll have me a penthouse, stacks and stacks of Bowling Green, EO11. EO11. It's all a state of mind, whether or not you find that place down there or heaven. In the meantime, EO, EO, EO 11, EO 11, EO 11. Show me a man without a dream, and I'll show you a man that's dead, real dead. Once I had me a dream, but that dream got kicked in the head, dream dead. I nearly had me that chauffeur and that block-long limousine, EO11, EO11. I nearly had me that penthouse, all them stacks of Bowling Green, EO11. Some judge is gonna say I'm putting you away for 4 score years and 7. In the meantime, EO 11.
Wow. James Bostic, Conservative's Perspective here on Patriot Nation Radio. Tuesday, we do it live, Tuesdays and Thursdays, starting at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. 2 hours tonight, 1 hour Thursday with Mark Hoffman. We're back-to-back Patriot Nation Radio live. Now standing 1-2 punch, maybe the best 1-2 punch in all of alternative radio. Not to mention, we've got another one coming. We've got oh gosh. We've got Ron Edwards coming up this evening. That wasn't what I was going to tell you about. What I was going to tell you about was the American Allegiance show, which is Kevin White's program, which is going to be on tomorrow night. Constitutional issues looked at. And Kevin's a terrific guy, and he is going to be a terrific host. He got off to a great start last Wednesday night, and I'm looking forward to being there with him this Wednesday as well. Kevin White, American Allegiance program. And, of course, then Ron Edwards, we're doing a simulcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. here on Patriot Nation at Blog Talk with the Ron Edwards American Experience. And that's Sundays, 3 p.m., the American Allegiance show, that's Kevin White. Our good friend Kevin's going to be on tomorrow night. That's Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Back to the question, can things get any worse? And if I recall, the answer was, oh, hell yeah. You better bet they can. And I was going to save this question for Ron, and we were going to talk about it, so I guess maybe that's what I'll do. One of the things that we'll get to, you know, one of the things that we have talked about here on the program have been the forensic audits that have been taking place in Maricopa County in Arizona, Fulton County in Georgia, Strong County, I think, that's in Philadelphia, that's Pennsylvania, where that's the home county, whatever the home county for Philly is. They've been doing it there. Michigan is getting on board with doing them, and we we know what we know. We're not stupid people. As a matter of fact, the folks who listen to conservative talk radio are considered considerably more intelligent than other kids whose dentists let them, you know, not listen to. But it's laboratory test acid proves conservatives are just smarter than liberals. That's all there is to it. And, you know, you guys here are no exception whatsoever. Welcome back. And it's frustrating, especially with this particular issue, to hear people on the right, including a lot of folks who know better, say that there's no different, you know, there's no evidence of serious or significant, possibly outcome-changing fraud in the last presidential election. And again, you know, they're saying this even as we find out, you know, just practically every other day with the updates we get from Maricopa County on the forensic audit there, which is getting ready to close up shop. They should have a report ready to issue by August, by the end of August at the very latest. And they're uncovering in every one of these places multiple discrepancies, multiple irregularities. And I think these people are clearly confusing evidence with proof. No, there may not be absolute incontrovertible proof of election fraud yet, but there is plenty of evidence. Good reasons a rational person might question the outcome. And here are 10 of them that come to mind, and not specifically in any order. Number one, eyewitness testimony. Since November 3rd, hundreds of people have come forward to report that they have personally witnessed various irregularities in the vote counting processes. Ballots run through tabulating machines multiple times. Pristine mail-in ballots. Ballots that appear to have been printed off on different paper or filled out by machines, the list goes on. Now, two questions come to mind. First, what would these witnesses stand to gain by making knowingly false claims? Many submitted actual affidavits, okay, submitting themselves to potential legal liability if, you know, it turns out that they're not telling the truth. Second, could it be that many people simply could be mistaken? No, I don't think that's likely either. Number two, our own eyes. Actually, the eyewitness testimony confirms what many of us have since seen for ourselves through security camera footage. Cases of ballots being pulled out from under tables in Fulton County, Georgia, right after observers were told to go home for the night. Vans were pulling up to the TCF Center in Detroit with dozens of boxes unloaded in the dead of night. We also saw on live television huge sudden jumps in vote totals for Biden, in some cases accompanied by corresponding drops in Trump totals. Are there innocent, plausible explanations? Maybe. I haven't heard one yet. Mostly we're just told, move along, folks. Nothing to see here. Number three, statistical anomalies. Some of the most persuasive evidence comes from mathematicians like Ed Solomon, who have conducted in-depth statistical analyses and have concluded that the reported election results are highly improbable, if not impossible. Documented anomalies include repeated percentages that could not occur naturally and number sequences that appear to violate Benford's law, gathering the standard distribution of first digits. I don't know what that means, and we're not going to get into it, but if it's math, it's, you know, okay. Both are considered valid indicators of fraud in criminal cases. Honest brownie, that lemonade rocks. Expert testimony, number four. something. Along with Solomon, we also have other internationally recognized experts like Jovan Hutton Pulitzer, who may have put their reputations on the line. In Pulitzer's case, he devised a method of forensically examining ballots using computer imaging. These kind of people have very little to gain from taking an unpopular position, and that they would do so openly for no other reason that they value the truth should speak volumes. Credible proponents. When pressed to choose between two sides of a controversial issue about which I'm unsure, typically I look at the proponents of the opposing views. If one side, for example, appears more honest and rational and credible than the other side, well, then I tend to lean that way. Beyond the experts, there are many election skeptics whose opinions I respect. Some are friends, some are family members, some are national figures like Garland Favorito. Garland Favorito, by the way, is a guy that's working on trying to get some things done in Fulton County through a series of lawsuits. Matthew DiPerno, especially David Clements, on whose Herculean efforts much of this information is based. Then there's the issue of constitutional questions. For me, one of the biggest issues is whether or not the election was conducted in accordance with the Constitution, and it appears that in several states it was not. The Constitution expressly cedes authority for conducting elections to state legislatures, but in Pennsylvania, election laws were changed by the executive branch and then upheld by the judiciary over the objections of the legislature. In the home state of, in Georgia, for example, the author's home state here, much of the election process seems to have been shaped by backroom deals between the governor and the shadow governor, which would, of course, be Stacey Abrams. Not exactly sure how either one of those episodes, those questions could be constitutional. Then we have to take a look at the stark lack of evidentiary hearings. But the courts have debunked all these allegations, the left says. No, not exactly. Yeah, most of them, but not all. Those lawsuits that have been brought to this point have been dismissed, mostly on technicalities. Very few courts have actually taken time to hear the evidence, and that brings to mind the old philosophical puzzle. You know, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around, make any noise. Well, if you have actual evidence, but the courts refuse to hear it, can it make a sound? And despite all those wins in court amid these absurd claims that this was the most secure, transparent, fairest election in history, Democrats seem oddly reluctant to allow for investigations. In fact, in Arizona and elsewhere, they appear to be in a state of abject panic, willing to do almost anything to disrupt, discredit, or delay the audits. So if there was no fraud, why then are they so adamant? Close to 50% of the country questions the election. Why not allow these audits to proceed and go ahead and put those doubts to rest? And we also have to look at the role that big tech propaganda played in this. Whether or not actual fraud occurred, there's no question that the big tech syndicates had its thumb on the scale, promoting false narratives that helped Biden, the Russian collusion, the good people lie, accusing Trump of downplaying the pandemic, and suppressing reports that might have hurt Joe Biden, in particular the Hunter Biden laptop story. Zuckerberg and Dorsey and all those guys essentially have admitted that much, and they continue right now as we speak to prop up and keep propping up the Biden administration using the same tactics. Now that, guys, is propaganda. And I'm not aware of any situation in history where propaganda was necessary to promote the truth. And finally, look, there's this. The whole thing just stinks. It stinks to high heavens. A sitting president earns more votes than any sitting president in history. He increases his vote totals among blacks, Hispanics, and women. He wins 18 of the 19 bellwether counties along with Florida, Iowa, and Ohio, long the guarantors of presidential victory. His party picks up seats in the House, and he still loses? Makes no sense. I may not be able to prove that it isn't true. But I'll tell you this, there's a lot of us out here that don't believe it for a minute. But, again, what's going to happen to anybody? What's going to happen to anybody? Well, what has happened to anyone? Not dead air, man. I'm just kicking it around. Trying to figure out where we're going to go next. I think we'll go with, I'm going to hold on to that. Hunter Biden. Let's talk about Hunter Biden. Artiste. Hunter Biden would appear to have everything that a materialistic narcissist could want. Wealth, power, fame, actually infamy, but why quibble? Sex, drugs, connections to more of the same, a battalion of enablers ranging from his family to a dominant political party to a nation's corporate news industry. Yet something appears to be missing with Hunter. Apparently, the son of the virtual president has been choking his inner muse. Why else would this most fortunate son take up art? Yeah, no, I'm not making this up. He's an artiste. Now, at the ripe old age of 51, well, making a little extra money never hurts. Biden's paintings, drawings, and collages will sell for between $75,000 and $500,000, said his art dealer, Georges Berger. That can buy a lot of crack and hookers. But something seems amiss. Only anonymous and confidential buyers will be eligible to purchase pieces from Biden's oeuvre. What? You mean no respectable art connoisseur or benefactor wants to be associated with an up-and-coming Picasso, Rembrandt, or even Warhol? Does the precocious artiste refuse to have the work of his innermost soul exposed to some of art's more influential patrons? Sarcasm aside, Biden's foray into art is anything but funny. It's sad. Not only does it reflect, number one, the Biden penchant for selling influence, it can enable some of the family's more noxious associates to avoid sanctions or launder money. Sometimes if you want to get a good look at American politics, you have to look at newspapers beyond American shores. And the Daily Mail is a good one for that. Jeff Earle from the Daily Mail discussed those dangers while he was writing an article about Biden's Hunter Biden, l'artiste. Experts are already warning of the risk of influence peddling, or at least the appearance of ethical conduct. When people buy paintings by the president's son in a market where sales are already murky and prices are extremely difficult to evaluate in an industry that can be used for what? Yeah, money laundering. One of those experts is Richard Painter. Get that? Art, painter, paint, never mind. Okay, one of those experts is Richard Painter, the chief ethics counsel for President George W. Bush from '05 to '07. Painter told the Washington Post that two groups of buyers could provide a lucrative market for Biden's art. lobbyists, for example, who want to earn favor with the virtual president, and the surreptitious representatives of foreign governments that would like to avoid economic sanctions. The Treasury Department specifically addressed those dangers. In October, it warned that the individuals, groups, or governments could use high-value art transactions to avoid sanctions and gain access to American markets and financial institutions. Bad actors, in other words, could exploit inherent weaknesses in the art market, such as a lack of transparency and a high degree of anonymity and confidentiality, especially with respect to the sale and purchase of high-value artworks. Shell companies and intermediaries are also frequently used to purchase, hold, or sell these artworks, as well as to remit and receive the payments. These avenues for maintaining anonymity allow blocked persons and other illicit actors to obscure their true identities from other market participants and help to hide prohibited conduct from law enforcement and regulators. The mobility, the concealability, and the subjective value of artwork further exacerbates its vulnerability to sanctions evasion. You know what's going to, okay, what this reminds me of, this is like a smaller version of, what was that called? Oh, the bill, the Clinton Global Initiative, or the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. Okay, they talk, the Peach Schweizer covered all that in Clinton Cash. And you know, that, this is no different. It was a pay-for-play scam. He turns out work that wouldn't even be seen, you know, in the bedrooms of Red Roof Inn. You know, it's crap, okay? It's crap. And everybody's going to hold it up and they're going to say, oh, God, this is the most beautiful crap I've ever seen in my life. This is genius. The boy's a genius. Just take my money. Just take my money. And the guy that's saying this, you know, happens to be the Minister of Defense for some Muslim-backed country that wants some sanctions so they can use that to avail themselves of the ability to damage the United States. Now, we go back and we tie this up with the fact that in Secret Empires, Pete Schweizer talks about this. The government, he's chairman of the Government Accountability Institute. And he talks about this and how deep into Chinese pockets the Bidens are. But not just the Bidens. His broker, Georges Berger, has ties to China. He's traveled to Beijing and Shanghai to purchase work from Chinese artists. And he regularly exhibits modern Chinese art. He's even considered opening up galleries in both cities. So now we have another Chinese connection. So this is another way for the Chinese to maintain the bribes and the money coming to the Biden family. Chinese purchasers acting at the behest of the communist government under the guise of anonymity spend a boatload of money on this paint-by-number crap this idiot's going to be. You know, dogs playing poker. Now, by God, there's some art, all right? But, I mean, this is crap, and this is just another conduit to run money to the Biden families from the communist Chinese. What's going to happen? Nothing's going to happen. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back with more of a conservative perspective right after this. Ron Edwards coming up at the bottom of the hour, 8:30. Ron Edwards of the Ron Edwards American Experience. Going to close out the show with us. Looking forward to that. Back after this.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see.
Dada? Dada!
I see a little silhouette of a clown. Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening.
Me, 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 me.
Galileo.
Me, me, me.
Galileo, Galileo, Figaro.
I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from his
monstrosity. No, no, no.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Ma, na,
let me throw.
Ma, na, ma, na. They will not let you throw.
Let me blow.
Ma, na, ma, na. They will not let you blow.
Let me jump.
Do not like your jokes.
Let me jump.
Do not like your jokes.
Let me jump.
No, 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 no!
Bernigini, Bernigini!
Mamma mia, let me go!
Shall everyone know if there is a fight for me? For me, for me!
So they tell us the video's going to
Scooter?
Yeah, Chief?
Remind me to stop setting up these video conferences. They're not very productive.
You got it.
Sheesh.
Believe it or not, that was made before Zoom. Talk about life imitating art. James Bostic, a conservative's perspective here. Patriot Nation Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Well, I really don't have much anything to say until Ron gets here at about 8:30, so I'm not... Oh, wow. You see why I call it the silly season? I mean, really, it's all stuff that's been going on, and it's bad, and we've got to pay attention to it, and we've got to look at it, but it just seems like nothing ever happens. I mean, it's all news, sure, yeah. And, you know, the guys that are paying attention to it here and there, their ears perk up or they raise an eyebrow. But what happens? And then again, is anything supposed to happen? I suppose it's a better question. You know, if it keeps on going like it has been for the 8 years with the left, I mean, just look at the unrest since the time of Barack Obama. Occupy Wall Street. You guys remember Occupy Wall Street and all the crap they did? Well, you know, these groups evolve and they morph and they splinter and they turn into other things. And we look at them and we go, okay, well, now we've got Antifa, we've got BLM, these splinter groups, and they're conducting all this property damage. They're conducting all this physical damage. And as I've said many times before, violence is very effective form of political theater for the left. It makes its imprint. It leaves, you know, garish images on the nightly news. It's bloody. It's painful. Things get broke. People get hurt. Its intent is to intimidate, to terrorize. You know, they make all this noise about calling us the domestic terrorists, that we're the internal terrorist threat. Really? Not dead air. I'm here. I've often wondered, and I do it all the time, you know, where is that breaking point? Where is that point of critical mass? It would seem to me, if we follow our junior high physics, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. And at some point, with groups like BLM, with groups like Antifa, with these left-wing terrorist organizations and individual bad actors as well, at some point, I've often said, you know, there's going to be pushback, and that pushback is going to be fierce. It's going to be frightening. And, you know, you want to talk about people getting hurt. Absolutely. There'll be a lot of people getting hurt. And I'm not an advocate of violence in any measure, but it would seem to me that if we look at the doctrine from eighth grade physical science, something's going to happen soon. And I've said that for a long time. And this evening, the thought just occurred to me that what if nothing happens? What if this just continues? And, you know, the only thing that happens is there's some low-grade grumbling, that there's some growling and rolling around, but that's it. And everything goes on the way the left wants it to go. Not dead air, man. Not dead air. I play this a lot. I haven't played it in a while, but, you know, it's just as accurate today as it was when it was in the movie theaters back in 1976.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Here's the question. How close are we to that? Really, how close are we? Biden and those insane Democrat bastards and the collusive Republicans that work with him have done miracles in terms of undoing the prosperity and the security and the sense of fraternity this nation has experienced for more than 200 years. So how about it? Are you mad? Are you mad as hell? Are you not going to take it anymore? I mean, this is, you know, it's coming down to an either or thing, I think, in my mind. And we either continue on this path that the left wants us to go down, that they seem to insist that we go down, the dull, oppressive uniformity of socialism at best, the soul-crushing tyranny at the worst. I don't know. I mean, it is... But you know, as Lincoln said, a house divided cannot stand. We must be all one thing or all the other. We cannot be both. And I'm not exactly sure where this goes. I used to think I knew, but I don't. Coming up here in a little bit, just a few minutes, I'm hoping he's going to call in here. Ron Edwards, host of the Ron Edwards American Experience, is going to be joining us. We have, as I told you earlier, a collaborative effort, and we talked about that last Thursday. Mark Hoffman had Ron and Kevin White as guests. Kevin White, the American Allegiance program, is coming on tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, dealing with issues, constitutional, newsy, and otherwise. We're going to take a look at that. That's going to be a great show. And then Sundays at 3 p.m. here on Patriot Nation, we're running a simulcast of the Ron Edwards American Experience with Ron doing his thing, and that's some great radio, straight-up great radio right there. We're heard live Tuesdays and Thursdays here on Patriot Nation Radio. We have a recorded version of the program that goes out on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you're not listening, you should be, because it is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. mojo50.com. What we're going to do, hopefully if Ron gets in here in just a little bit, and he's due to call, we're going to talk about the silent majority. Now, that is a term that has been around for a long time throughout history, but we're not going to go back any further than President Nixon's coinage of it during 1969-1968. And the silent majority were those middle-income Americans, middle-class Americans, who weren't protesting the Vietnam War. They weren't joining the counterculture. And those were two activities in that day that were vastly overreported by the media at that time. The silent majority didn't necessarily speak up, but they respected traditional American values with a good-natured approach to political issues. And more importantly, they voted. And in 1972, Richard Nixon was reelected with one of the largest landslides in American history, 520 electoral votes to only 17 for George McGovern. They have, throughout history from that point on factored, I think, in probably every major, I don't know what you want to call them, I guess maybe everybody says constitutional crisis, and that, you know, that phrase is so overused, it's so overplayed, and I'm loath to use it here, but every important or seminal moment in this country's history has been supported, buttressed in some way, or pushed back against in some way by this silent majority. And at first, when I looked at that, I used to think that I understood it. And as I grew older, then I realized I didn't at first, but I certainly do now. And it's just exactly that thing. It's these people that want to raise their families. They want to work their jobs. If they have a business, they want to have a little bit of profit from it so they can enjoy the fruits of their labor, so they can provide for their families, so they can get good schools and decent education for their kids and be left alone. It's a very unique, very, very American concept. Live and let live. But we don't see that today. And we're seeing, you know, we see less and less of it every day. It's not live and let live. It's do what I say. And maybe we'll let you live. And that's not how this works. Not dead air, just thinking about it. So where does that pushback come from? I don't know. I really don't. And where is the hope? You know, a lot of times on Gary's program, he'll have his guests talk about the dire situations, you know, that we face here in America and as Americans. And he always, you know, he wants to leave them upbeat, and he wants to come back with, you know, how do we come back from the edge, is what he always likes to ask him. You know, is there a pathway beyond this place where we're at right now? I don't know. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Something we should keep in mind, though, are these words from President Donald Trump.
America is a land of heroes, a place where greatness is born, where destinies are forged, and where legends come to life. This is the home of Thomas Edison and Teddy Roosevelt, of many great generals, including Washington, Pershing, Patton, and MacArthur. This is the home of Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Amelia Earhart, Harriet Tubman, the Wright brothers, Neil Armstrong, and so many more. This is the country where children learn names like Wyatt Earp, Davy Crockett, and Annie Oakley. This is the place where the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth and where Texas Patriots made their last stand at the Alamo. The American nation was carved out of the vast frontier by the toughest, strongest, fiercest, and most determined men and women ever to walk on the face of the earth. Our ancestors braved the unknown, tamed the wilderness, settled the Wild West, lifted millions from poverty, disease, and hunger, vanquished tyranny and fascism, ushered the world to new heights of science and medicine, laid down the railroads, dug out the canals, raised up the skyscrapers. Our ancestors built the most exceptional republic ever to exist in all of human history, and we are making it greater than ever before. This is our glorious and magnificent inheritance. We are Americans. We are pioneers. We are the pathfinders. We settled the new world. We built the modern world, and we changed history forever by embracing the eternal truth that everyone is made equal by the hand of Almighty God. America is the place where anything can happen. America is the place where anyone can rise. And here, on this land, on this soil, on this continent, the most incredible dreams come true. This nation is our canvas, and this country is our masterpiece. We look at tomorrow and see unlimited frontiers just waiting to be explored. Our brightest discoveries are not yet known. Our most thrilling stories are not yet told. Our grandest journeys are not yet made. The American age, the American epic, the American adventure has only just begun. Our spirit is still young. The sun is still rising. God's grace is still shining. And my fellow Americans, the best is yet to come.
Stirring words from the President of the United States, former President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. Ladies and gentlemen, Ron Edwards, host of the Ron Edwards American Experience, is with us right now. He came in just as he said he would. He is an accomplished talk radio host, a remarkably intelligent and articulate fellow, and we are very proud to be collaborating with Ron on Sunday afternoons, 3 p.m. We run a simulcast of the Ron Edwards American Experience right here on Patriot Nation Radio, and it gives me great pleasure and no small amount of pride to introduce a new friend to Patriot Nation, Mr. Ron Edwards. Ron, welcome to A Conservative Perspective. We're really glad to have you with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and thanks for the invite, and man, it's great to, again, to be on your show.
What I would like to do, and we've got 30 minutes, and I have just a few questions, and I'm just going to toss them out, and I'm going to let you attack them as you will. The first one, and I'm really curious about this, I would like to know what began, if anything, if you even have one, and I think you probably do, what began your love affair with radio, and if there
Wow.
was ever, if there was ever in your life a time, you know, if there was ever some kind of an ideological road to Damascus moment, and I don't know, maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, or was there at one point where you just recognized the inherent practicality and common sense of capitalism and conservatism? And the last thing that I would like to hear you expound upon is the silent majority, or the people that would represent that term as we would understand it today. And, you know, that's something that's been around since Nixon in the late 1960s. And it was that group of people that paid their taxes, worked their jobs, raised their kids, wanted to be left alone. They didn't join the Vietnam War protest. They didn't join the counterculture, but they did vote. And I think that now we see that silent majority becoming less and less silent. And I'm just going to turn you loose. I'd like to hear what you have to say about all that.
Well, the beginning of my journey in radio, it started in earnest, believe it or not. I was about 8 years of age, and every morning before getting ready for school, I would hear this man named Paul Harvey.
Yes.
I was attracted to the voice, and I was just amazed. I said, "Oh my God, he sounds like God," and. I really got into what he was saying over time, and it was just amazing. And it was so funny because he would point out a lot of the principles that my dad would talk about, but he would do it in even more of a story form. And so I related in that way. And from there, as far as my love affair with the radio, I also used to listen late at night the stations all over the country that would filter in.
Yeah.
Whether it was WABC in New York, whether it was WCFL in Chicago, CKLW in Windsor across the river from Detroit, all these great radio stations, and yet I remember the personalities and all of that. And ironically, growing up in Cleveland, my family knew radio personalities, and sometimes they'd drop over and tease me and stuff because I was a little guy, and you know, and we just would have fun with these people. And I just gained an interest in radio. And I used to say, I know beginning at around 11, I'm going to be in radio. And it happened at 16 because I won a contest. And, you know, teenagers were allowed to have a contest. We participated in a weekly contest. And if you got a majority of votes or whatever, you got some kind of prize. Well, I was on, and my God, Billy B, that was the program director's name, he called me and said, Ron, we never had this level of a response to a winner before. It's just overwhelming. And next thing you know, they offered me a weekend, basically a talking head, you know, gig, read the headlines and stuff like
right.
that on the weekends. So I got to leave my grocery because I had a grocery store job. And I got to leave that. I didn't, you know, I loved the people I was working with. I was happy to be working, but I wasn't crying about switching jobs. And at 16, starting out in a major market, I didn't know it was a big deal. I thought it was just another job like at the grocery store, just a job I wanted to do. And it just grew from there. I left radio for a few years when I went to school in New York at City College and or City University, basically, and did commercials when I was in New York. And so I kept my voice alive that way and was in some theater off-Broadway stuff. And because of illness, I returned to the Midwest, back to Cleveland. And I was misdiagnosed in New York and almost died. And so went back to Cleveland, to Cleveland Clinic, and they came back with a solution right after my checkup and everything. And while I was recovering, because I was thinking about going back to New York, I get a call from my old radio station. And I'm like, well, how in Sam Hill did you all find out that I'm here? And they said, don't worry about it, but we want to know if you want to come back to work. And I let them know that I was in recovery and I was planning on going back to New York. And they said, well, don't worry about that either. What are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm sitting down, obviously talking to you. He says, what are you going to be doing? What were you doing at the radio station? Well, producing newscasts for the top of the hour and, you know, sitting down talking over the air. He says, well, what's the problem? So needless to say, I went back to work and completely recovered. And next thing you know, after a year or so, still thinking about getting back to the Big Apple, my favorite city in all the world. And I got a call from two radio stations in the Detroit metro area. And I'm like, oh, man, I did not know that Detroit was like it is and or anything like that. I had no idea. I'd never seen anything like that in all of my travels throughout the country. And yet people were saying, you don't want to go to Detroit. You don't want to go there. But me, I'm like, I decided to go. I decided, you know what, I'll be there a couple of years and I'll get back to New York. And I came up and I saw Detroit and I was mortified. I was freaking mortified. And yes, I always had conservative Christian leanings, grew up that way because of my dad, but it really slapped the crap out of me. It's like a slap across the face to wake me up. Because I had always had this thought, I think I've mentioned it on you guys' station in the past, was more like a vision that there would be one city that would represent what would happen to the entire country if we didn't get our moral and economic house in order. And all of Detroit was just messed up. I said, oh, my God. Every city has bad areas, whether it's the battle zone in Boston, part of the east side of Cleveland. You know, we all have their
right.
sections.
But everywhere I went in Detroit was like that. Downtown looked like the ghetto of Cleveland. And it was just awful. And I got frightened because I said, oh, Lord, we're the richest country in the world and we have this all over. And there were more churches in Detroit than anywhere else. And that also struck me. And that freaked me out, too. I said, well, dang, look at all these churches, big churches, small churches, in-between churches, everywhere, more churches than businesses on many of the main boulevards, like Gratiot Avenue and all of that. But kind of freaked me out. I said, either all these Christians are liars or everyone is stupid. I just couldn't figure it out. But it didn't take long to figure it out. The city was steeped in socialism for many years, since the 60s, and that was just the end result of it. And immorality. Morality was drained away, and the city became evolved from being the wealthiest in the world to a third world, abysmal, it was just horrible. It was just awful. And like I said, I was freaked out, and the people that were with me, they were showing me around and everything. They were like, are you okay? I said, well, I said, physically I am, but this is terrible. This is what hath you wrought. In fact, that was the first thing I said to the people over the air. It was a morning magazine talk show. It was called Morning Magazine, and the first thing that came out of my mouth is I'm looking out over the skyline of Detroit from the top of the Penobscot building. What have you people wrought? What have you done? You were the richest city in the world. Why would you give up all this wealth over politics, over bitterness? Because that's all I heard. The white man this, the white man that. Why didn't you take the time to build on the positives and stop worrying about the white man and start worrying about the man in the mirror and building up like Frederick Douglass did? And I just, it was just a constant battle with people. And I finally got it. Why everyone was warning me, don't go to Detroit. Because they said, they listened to you in Cleveland. They listened to you elsewhere. But they will not listen to you in Detroit. They're much more, they're very prideful of where they're at. And they're proud of it. And like I said, I didn't get it because I said, oh, they're Americans just like anywhere else. You got the good and the bad and blah, blah, blah. Because life for me, I won't say it was easy in New York, but it was very good. It was a city of opportunity. At that time, if you walked into New York and you had some skills and a little brain and you're going to school, opportunities were just everywhere. And that's what had happened to me. You either party yourself into a dither or you work yourself into a dither. And I worked myself into a dither because I was just so in love with all the opportunities. I'm like, what are these people complaining about? What is the problem? And I got jobs and did well in jobs that I could never get, even in my hometown of Cleveland. And I was just amazed. And I'd even hear some of the blacks even in New York complaining about this, that, and the other. And I'm like, who cares if that white guy walking down the street doesn't like you or not? Love yourself more than he hates you. And appreciate the good of this country and build upon it, and it doesn't matter. Because, you know, these people that they're continuing to worry about, like the Black Lives Matter, there's a racist behind every doorknob. There's a racist in every crack of the walls. You know, they're just crazy on that. And that's what this woke crap is about, to keep everybody focused on, as they used to say in church, majoring in the minors. And this woke culture is nothing but a mentally minimalizing enterprise. If you're just focused on, well, you know what, that guy's white, so
they're going to practice white supremacy. So automatically, the leftist whites are telling the black children, well, you know, they're indirectly telling them, well, you know, you're inferior, you're not quite as bright, and so therefore you should hate the white guy because they're going to be superior over you and they're going to practice supremacy. And I'm like, what in the world? Why are we allowing ourselves to have the game run on us in such a manner? It doesn't make sense. Because, and I love to use examples like Lewis Latimer and many other blacks who excelled magnificently because they didn't, if they paid attention to it, it wasn't in the forefront of their minds. I mean, if you read their writings, the forefront in their minds was, oh, I've got to get this invention done, or I've got to work and build a house for my family. I mean, it was those kind of struggles, more so than the racism of the day, which was greater than it is now. And when I discovered through the years that if you go back to the 40s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, each decade, black Americans were becoming wealthier as a whole and stronger. We owned 40-something, I think 42% of black Americans owned small businesses. I mean, it was, when you look back on black American history, I'm like, wow, there were some incredible things going on. Black hospitals, black hotels. And in some cases, they were 4- and 5-star hotels. And when I learned all this stuff, it all clicked. I learned a lot of it, most of it growing up, but it clicked when I moved to Michigan. It's like I went from just an ambitious young guy to a more awakened American who became very concerned about the country. My dad taught me about and taught me how she should be and how she can be, the good. And I saw it going away from that. And, you know, being a young guy in the 1980s, I mean, that was the ultimate. That was the ultimate. I mean, my God. And I was kind of naive. I thought Americans are having a good time. It's great. They're going to build on this. They're not going to let this go. But they did that they did that exactly. They let it go when the worst Bush, Bush Sr., got in office. It's going away then. Mr. No New Taxes. And I noticed the change. And I said, oh, my God, we're going to be slipping backwards. And then when Clinton came into office, thank God for Newt Gingrich, and Clinton wanted to look good, so they worked together and things got better economically again. But then we started slipping back again. And we in this country, my friend, have to share. I forget the movie, but there's a movie scene. I guess the movie came out in the 80s or whatever, where she slaps the crap out of somebody and says, snap out of it. We have to to be slapped out of this woke culture, because the woke culture is putting America to sleep. And
do you
that's
think,
how you put
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, again, with the woke culture, with the cancel culture, with the physical and the property damage that we've seen over the last basic, you know, 5 years, 6 years, with Occupy Wall Street and Antifa and BLM and all these different things, are we reaching that point where again, like I said, the silent majority is not going to remain silent, and every action, as I said earlier, has an equal and opposite reaction. And at some point, is there going to be some pushback? Sometimes I think that it's inevitable, but then other times, honestly, I wonder, are we just, you know, is there just going to be some grumbling and growling and then we're steamrolled, or do we stop it?
Well, Lord have mercy. I know we should stop it. And the sooner we decide to stand up and say hell to no and no to hell, in regards to all the cultures you just mentioned, the woke and all of that, the less difficult it will be to shut it down. But we're getting to a point where the only way to stop it will be violence. Because they have secured control of every major entity in the country, whether it's media, the main denominations in church. Most of your big-time ministers are basically closet globalist pigs oinking out half-truths and raking in billions. T.D. Jakes, I'll name him because this was a public situation and an example. He had Dr. Fauci at his church. And he had the nerve to say that, no, it was another minister, but he had the nerve to have Fauci in there, and he and Fauci are together promoting the shots to the black community. Come on in. And that was around the time, where a reasonably healthy Hank Aaron went on television in Atlanta and took his shot. And 18 days later, he had assumed atmospheric temperature. Black Americans should have caught on then. They should have caught it. I mean, they catch it if one man dies at the hands of a police officer. So they should have caught it when one man died at the hands of these goofballs giving out these shots. And this fake minister. And I normally I wouldn't call a minister out by name because we're not supposed to, but because he made this a public deal, he made a big deal out of getting Fauci there, and in my opinion, harming his parishioners with the shot, encouraging them to hurt themselves with this shot. But this is what we're up against in every entity. You've got many conservative hosts on Fox. Brian Kilmeade. Oh, yeah, today. Yeah, I took the shot. And Sean Hannity saying we should take the shot. You know, when you have all this foolishness on our side, that's when I wonder, man, how far is this stuff going to go and how will we get out of it? But if we stand up now, if we push back now, we can do it without violence. But we have to do it in unison, and we have to do it in so many numbers that we make an impact, especially financially, like they did in, Poland under Lech Walesa.
Ron, we only have about, I'm sorry, we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to make sure that folks know how to catch. I know, it blistered by. We're going to have to do an hour next
time.
5 minutes.
God.
It really
did. That much?
Seriously, we're down to 2 minutes. And I want folks to know, where they can find out more about the Ron Edwards American Experience and also the Ron Edwards Notebook.
Well, the Edwards Notebook plays overnight on hundreds of stations via Salem on Captain's America Third Watch. And I'm also a regular contributor on that show. The Ron Edwards American Experience can be heard daily, Sunday through Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific on Spreaker, and there are radio stations and everything, but everyone can reach me on Spreaker.com, or you can simply go to the RonEdwards.com, that's my website, and you can click on live right there at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, and that's the Ron Edwards American Experience.
Thank you so much once again, Ron, for being on the show. I had a terrific time talking with you, and I'm hoping that you'll be coming back.
Well, when you invite me, I will be back.
Well, we're going to invite you. You can bet on that. Ladies and gentlemen, Ron Edwards, the Ron Edwards American Experience. Thank you so much, Ron. We will be talking to you soon. I promise that.
Thank you, sir. Godspeed. Take care.
Thank you. Man, that was awesome. A terrific guy. You know, like I said, we're doing a simulcast on Sundays, 3 p.m. We're running the Ron Edwards American Experience right here on Patriot Nation. That's all the time we've got. Man, that was terrific. Thanks once again to Ron Edwards for being here. Again, the Ron Edwards American Experience. Get out there and find it. Clearly a man worth listening to. That's all the time we've got. We'll be back here Thursday, in all likelihood, Lord willing, and the river don't rise, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. Take good care of yourselves. We'll see you on Thursday.